Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political, and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Hey everybody, I think we're all here. It's quite a panorama here really, isn't it? I kind of feel our speakers ought to maybe get up and walk around a little bit with microphones, something like that, but I don't think we'll be doing that. Thanks everybody for coming along to this session. My name's Jim Butcher and I'm going to be chairing the session, although it will be very much a discussion with the audience. This session is put on, sponsored by the Don't Divide Us campaign, which does, as some of you will know, absolutely sterling work in challenging divisive narratives in education. And so what we've got here are three speakers who've got books out this year looking at the issue of race. And this is the title of our session here, Let's Talk About Race. So we want an open discussion. Just by way of introduction, I'm going to keep the introductions very, very brief because I'm sure there's so much to say about these very diverse books and ideas, and you'll have plenty of questions. It's not assumed at all that you've read the books, by the way. The speakers will give you an insight into what they're arguing in the context of the politics of race today. But I couldn't help noticing recently at my own university that I teach at, this isn't all about universities, by the way, but as you'll realise, race politics is a big, big thing in universities. But at my university, we have a kind of an official reading list on race that the university has issued, and it's not untypical that the universities have done similar. The official reading list on race features Robin DiAngelo, Ibrahim Kendi, Kendi Andrews, Afua Hirsch. It doesn't feature any of these three here. And I'll leave it to you to work out whether that's justified or not at the end of the talk. I don't think it is. So we're going to take the speakers in the order. Raqib Aysen, first of all. Raqib's book is titled Beyond Grievance, What the Left Get Wrong, about ethnic minorities. Raqib, as many of you will know, is a prominent British authority on matters of racial identity and social integration, and he's written for so many different publications. You can look it all up online and the various different things that Raqib does. Likewise, Remy. Former journalist, now academic at the University of York. His book is titled, It's Not All About Whiteness, It's About Wealth. So you can probably glean something about, even from the title, where Remy's coming from there. And Remy's also a member of the Home Office Strategic Race Board, amongst many, many other things. And finally, we've got Doug Stokes, who's a professor in international security at the University of Exeter, and a senior advisor to the Legatum Institute. And his book is the only one I have because I read the other two on my Kindle here, so I'll hold up his, Against Decolonization, Campus Culture Wars, and the Decline of the West. So I'm going to invite the speakers to introduce for 5 or 6 minutes on their books, on their ideas, on what they want to talk about. I've got a couple of short questions and then it'll be out to the audience. The discussion might be quite eclectic, but we can deal with that. And really interested to hear what you think, regardless of whether you've read the books, whether it's a question or a disagreement or a contribution that you'd like to make. So to begin with, Raqib.
Right. Thank you, Jim, and absolute pleasure to share a platform with Remy and Doug. Here is Beyond Grievance. I just checked on Amazon Prime. It's now priced at £8.73, which I think is an absolute bargain. Next day delivery as well. So in terms of why I authored the book, I think that the driving motivation for me is that I look at our race relations conversation and I feel that many elements of it are fundamentally toxic. Not just toxic, but in my view, pseudo-intellectual is a term that I use a great deal in my book. And I think that when you're looking at racial and ethnic disparities, I think many of the debates that we've had in recent times, they haven't been rooted in evidence, and they certainly haven't been rooted in reason. And I think one of the main things I really wanted to achieve with the book was to challenge those myths, those problematic narratives, and to actually provide a picture on the ground, which is actually quite positive. I wouldn't say that I look at my own country through rose-tinted spectacles, but I think that there are positives to be taken in terms of our record on race relations. I think that when you look at other countries such as France, Germany, the Netherlands, you know, European countries which are also racially and ethnically diverse, I think we do actually fare better than those countries when it comes to integration. Now, that's not to say that we can't make improvements in terms of integration. I think events that we've seen in the last few weeks suggest that there are improvements to be made, for sure. And I think when you look at the large-scale public disorder last year in Leicester, I think that we also have to talk about these very clear tensions between different ethnic and religious minorities. So I think the issue is not so much Britain's record on race. I think that Britain's record on race in recent times has actually been very good. I think that when you look at the race, the Equality Act from 2010, I know that many people have an issue with the Equality Act. And it's mind-boggling that Labour seem to want to introduce a race Equality Act. This seems to be their biggest idea at the moment. For all its flaws, the UK comfortably outperforms other European countries such as France, Germany, the Netherlands, Spain and Italy, and Commonwealth partners such as Australia and New Zealand when it comes to providing anti-discrimination protections on the grounds of race, ethnicity and religion. Our race relations legislation, which was passed in the 60s, this was passed while the White Australia policy was still in place in Australia. So I think it really tells you how advanced the UK has been on these kind of issues. And there's one event in particular that really shows how the UK has been far advanced compared to the United States, is the Battle of Bamber Bridge during the Second World War, where US commanders tried to enforce American South-style segregation in a Lancastrian village. And the pub landlords there said, no thanks, we don't do that here in the UK. So I think that there are certainly positives that we can really take from our record on race relations. And that's something I discuss a great deal in the book. But as I said, I wouldn't say I have an overly romanticised vision of the UK, or rather perception of it. I still talk about how there are improvements to be made in terms of labour market integration. I also talk about healthcare, where there has to be a need for at least understanding what are the barriers to access in terms of healthcare. But the thing is, a lot of those barriers might be within communities, and that's something that we really need to grapple, and we have to tackle that. I think that policing seems to be a very big topic at the moment, and I think there needs to be a discussion in terms of how we can restore public trust in policing more broadly. The Met in recent times has been it really put itself in hot water in recent times with many scandals. More recently, we've seen the Met being very active on X, explaining what the term jihad means in different contexts. I think that the Met just needs to return to the bread and butter of policing. But for me, I think that something that I actually argue for in the book is that I think the Met is finished as an institution. I think it's far too big to succeed. I think a mass clear out is needed, but I don't think that's enough. We need fundamental reform in terms of how policing works in London, whether that you have smaller police forces or you have existing parts of London absorbed in existing police forces such as Kent, Essex, Hertfordshire, etc. So I think with the book, I say that for all our flaws, I think our multiracial democracy is in decent shape, especially when you look at an international context. But there's still improvements to be made in terms of how institutions work and how we manage diversity more generally in the UK. So I talk a great deal about a robust civic nationalism, which has to focus on Britain's history and heritage. And I even argue that if you want to have a successful and truly inclusive form of anti-racism, that again has to be rooted in Britain's history and heritage. It can't draw inspiration from the United States, which is a totally different national and cultural context. And more generally about integration, I also criticise the French style of sort of this rigid secular universalism. I don't think that's entirely helpful if you're looking to integrate more socially conservative minorities, especially in France's case, Muslim communities that might originate from North Africa and West Africa. So I think on the one thing I wanted to do with the book was to really make a positive contribution to those debates, which are often quite polarised. In my view, a lot of those contributors to those conversations are bad faith. So I hope that people who have read the book or would like to read the book, when they do read it, they feel that I've engaged with these topics in good faith.
That's great. Thank you, Rafi. Uh, And next up is Remy.
Yeah, thank you. So while Rakib takes a very focused on the UK approach to the race debate, my book takes a little bit more of an international perspective on it. And a bit of this has to do with my background. So I wasn't brought up in Britain. I grew up in Nigeria, the son of a Nigerian father and a Polish mother. Spent the first 17 years of my life there, went to primary and secondary school in Nigeria. Then I moved to Poland, my mother's homeland, where I went to university and lived for many years. And then I finally moved to the UK in 2015. So I've lived in three different countries and experienced the race issue, let's say, in three different countries. I wanted to try and answer the question of why the BLM slogan, that slogan of Black Lives Matter, seemed to resonate so loudly in so many parts of the world. Because while it wasn't surprising that it resonated strongly in the US, in the US context, and perhaps also not that terribly surprising that it resonated here in the UK, I was somewhat surprised at how much it resonated in Africa. So I was following African Twitter accounts during that, you know, summer of 2020, and there were huge emotions there, and there was huge outrage there. And you could really see that that message of Black Lives Matter sort of resonated. And so the question was, why? The common theme I seem to identify in the Kenyan who lives in Nairobi and has never met a white police officer in their life, and probably will never meet a white police officer in their lives, and the Black American in America, and the Black Briton here in Britain, seem to be this shared sense of a global disregard for blackness. That slogan of Black Lives Matter resonated strongly with a lot of people. And surveys show, both here in the UK and in the US, and that kind of public opinion showed in an African context, that people do feel that there still does exist some kind of informal racial order, which generally speaking positions white people at the top, black people at the bottom, and everyone else somewhere in between. And you have African students who complain of discrimination and racism in China, in Arab countries where they are in India, same goes for that. Arundhati Roy, for instance, a very well-known Indian writer, commented during that 2020 period that racism against black people among Indians was far worse than the racism amongst white Westerners towards black people, that is a much bigger problem in India there. And so this is something which is a general concern. So the question is, okay, fine. If we assume that this kind of implicit racial order does still function to some greater or lesser extent, what is behind it? Because generally speaking, morally, pretty much everyone seems to be on the same page that there shouldn't be racial hierarchies, there shouldn't be any racial order, there shouldn't be racial discrimination. So what then is sustaining this hierarchy? Some give the answer racism, ideology of white supremacy. And there's a lot of focus here on the ideology of whiteness and all sorts of deconstructions of whiteness and things like that. I think that is not the answer. I think the answer lies in what holds the structure of that order together. Generally speaking, what holds the structure of the global order together, and that is wealth. In a world that functions on money, in a world that is a capitalist world, generally speaking, collective wealth is what differentiates groups. Collective wealth is what decides status in our world. Collective wealth is what decides power in our world. And so I try to show this very clearly, and there's clear statistics I try to cite in the book. One simple one: Britain has a larger GDP than all of Africa. Britain has a larger GDP than all of Africa. And it's worth remembering in the racial context that only 3% of the black people in this world live in America and Britain combined. Only 3%. 90% of the black people in this world live in Africa. The other 7% live scattered across Latin America and the Caribbean countries. And one single Briton here has a larger GDP than Africa. If you add all the GDPs of all the black majority nations in the world, in Africa and in the Caribbean, they still amount to less than Germany's $4 trillion GDP. So that's the kind of world we live in. Another simple statistic: Britain's national budget for this year is roughly £1.2 trillion. That's roughly $1.5 trillion. That's how much the British state has to fund the NHS, provide services, and all these things we have around us. The largest black nation in the world, Nigeria, its budget equivalent for the year in dollars is $30 billion. So you have a country of 68 million people here in the UK that has a budget of $1.5 trillion. And then you have a country of 200 plus million people in Africa, Nigeria, that has a budget of just $30 billion. Those are the kinds of, that's the world we live in. And now the point is not really to point fingers at, okay, how did this all come about and why is Britain rich and Nigeria isn't rich, etc. I don't focus on that. Books have been written about the transatlantic slave trade, colonialism, and all these things. I'm focused on the now. So what I try to do is make the argument showing people how in everyday life, it's really these socioeconomic realities that create the status systems that exist and that create those power differentials between, let's call it the broader speaking, a white Western racial group and black people. And I try to show this by looking at various spheres that are key in our world. For instance, knowledge production, academia. And if you look at the rankings of the universities, you find 36 of the top 50 universities in the world are based in the West, mostly in Britain and America. And that's the reason why there is significant domination of knowledge production within the West, which is often complained about. And this also goes back to the resources which these universities have. The budget of Oxford University, for instance, for 2022 amounted to £2 billion. That was larger than the entire education budget of Nigeria as a state. So that's just to give an example. So this is what is driving that, sort of domination in knowledge production, not racism, as some would say, and decolonizing the curriculum is not going to change any of this because it's not going to put a penny more in the budgets of Nigerian universities or Kenyan universities, and that's actually what is needed. So that's, for instance, academia. What about visa power? One complaint about amongst a lot of people of black descent, especially of African descent, is that, Westerners are able to travel all around the world, usually often visa-free, whereas black people can't. That's probably because of racism. It's because of the racial order. However, if you look at the passport power rankings, there's a passport power ranking which is prepared every year, which essentially measures how many countries a passport enables you to travel to visa-free or with visa on arrival. So the most powerful passports are the countries that where people can travel, citizens can travel to most countries. And the most powerful passport in 2021, the ranking I used then, was the passport of the United Arab Emirates. Not of a white country, but of the United Arab Emirates, because it is an incredibly wealthy country. And generally speaking, while European countries tend to dominate that passport power list, you also have countries like Japan, Singapore, etc. And you could almost match that list with GDP per capita figures. So the countries, nations that essentially have very high GDP per capitas are welcome all over the world because countries want people, nationals of wealthy countries to come to their country, spend money, etc. That's what's driving this, not race. If Britain was a poor country today with a GDP per capita of $3,000 per year instead of $42,000 per year, Brits would probably be queuing up for visas also. That's the world we live in. So I look at, the whole immigration patterns. Why do we have, migration flowing from one part of the world to the other part? And that's often because of resources also. Then I look at the technology, international influence, cultural power, hard power, all the various spheres that decide which groups get to have more agency in the world, which groups decide what's not. And this does come down to, this does often come down to wealth. So the solution for us, if we're thinking 90% of the black population live in Africa, must be African wealth creation, yeah, which is the key to black wealth creation. And without that happening, we will always be at a disadvantage. And we will always be complaining about, colonialism and racism, etc., while not actually addressing the key source of our structural weakness, because there is a structural weakness there, but it boils down to wealth, and that's what we have to deal with.
Fantastic. Thank you. And finally, Doug.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to give it a sort of autobiographical take here. I had Claire Fox yesterday say, don't give a lecture, so I'm not going to give you a lecture. So my book's not again. It looks at the illiberalism in UK universities, it's a lament about that. I grew up in a very multiracial background. I was born in a poor working class family in Hackney, marched against racism, National Front, Cenotaph, British National Party, a long history of anti-racism. Right. So I was the first person in my family to ever go to university, and I got there and I thought, this is great. It's kind of like really quiet, progressive, and it's kind of cozy and nice like that. But then But then about four years ago, there was a real change in university cultures where it became increasingly illiberal and highly authoritarian. And then you had this kind of imposition of what were essentially kind of interesting but fringe ideas in social science, humanities, i.e. sort of post-colonialism and post-modernism, etc., adopted by UK university executive teams and then imposed from the top down. And so the book really is looking at this kind of decolonial theory and in particular way in which it was imposed from the top down by the executive teams and some of the highly illiberal and authoritarian tendencies that we see in that and what that's done to campus cultures. And given that broader UK public culture is downstream from UK universities, very precious things that kind of help to sort of corral our cultural narratives, etc., then it has quite highly illiberal effects in there too. So I'll give you some examples. What I started to see on UK campuses was more and more training around microaggressions. Now, this is, especially like racial microaggressions. There were some reports done by the EHRC in 2019 that essentially said, we've driven out overt racism on UK campuses, fantastic, but now it's far more covert. And it's ubiquitous and everywhere. And so how do they measure these things? Well, essentially it's microaggressions. So I was like, well, I'm spend most of my life on university campuses, and what's this about? And so they gave some examples in these reports, and these reports were adopted by university executive teams to justify this kind of decolonial, authoritarian agenda that we saw that's a real threat to academic freedom and basically pluralism and liberal values on the university campus. What were some examples that the EHRC gave, direct examples? One of them was a lecturer's or an academic's body language when they speak to somebody, how they stand. One was raised eyebrows. If a white academic talks to a minority ethnic student and they raise their eyebrows, that could be potentially coded as a racial microaggression. Another example they gave was a black student. This is a direct example from the EHRC. A black student was in the lift. A white student went to get in the lift, changed their mind and went down the stairs. And that was felt to be a racial microaggression. Another one was discussions of Brexit on UK campuses, which I quote, have introduced a cold wind across UK university campuses. So we had this kind of like this really quite authoritarian, illiberal concept of microaggressions where the way I walk, and I come from Hackney, I kind of swagger a little bit, you know what I mean? I was. Anyway, it could be potentially coded as a, who knows, am I being watched? Am I, so is that like that? And then unconscious bias and stuff like this. So essentially it was the policing of the unconscious mind. So this was a really quite odd thing. And I thought this was also very damaging to UK relationships, the natural respect that should operate between student and the academic. And it was also highly patronizing because, and so the book is also about how we understand, where does this stuff come from? And what I try to say is not only is it the adoption of decolonial, post-colonial, and postmodern theories by university executive teams, but it's also a quest for some sort of weird Blairite managerialism, where they kind of want to sort of police your thoughts and ultimately uplift these vulnerable students and vulnerable populations. And it's very, very patronizing as well. I find it very, very patronizing. It kind of reproduces the dyad between the parent and the adult. So I kind of look at this and I sort of unpack some of these ideas in the book. I look at sort of decolonial theory, interesting, but in terms of its adoption and imposition, I find it highly liberal, quite dangerous to pluralism and liberal values on UK campuses. And then I kind of relate this to some of the bigger issues in terms of where this comes from and the collapse of confidence on kind of institutions in Great Britain, etc. So that's the kind of book. I'm sure we'll unpack more in the questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Well, I'm going to start off by just asking each of the panelists a question of my own, and then it's going to be up to you guys to disagree and take up each other's points as well. So we want to have a real discussion between everybody, really. I'm going to start off with Rakib. Rakib, in your book, something I sort of recognised because it's part of my background too, I suppose, in a way, was a sort of orientation towards the left of politics and traditions on the left of politics, and also the Labour Party. And at the end of some of the chapters, you refer to the Labour Party and or bemoan at times some of the directions that the Labour Party's taken. And you say at one point you offer family and faith and community as something that can, as you put it, take aim at capitalistic mindsets and some of the sort of fragmentation and atomization that you identify. And you say that the Labour Party was always the natural party for you, and family, civic duty and social rootedness was a feature of the old left, you put it that way. So I'd like to put you on the spot a little bit here, because at the same time, you identify that a lot of the divisive trends in race politics have also found a home in the Labour Party and on broadly the left. I don't want to get into a sort of party political issue here, but I'm just interested in exploring a little bit how you see this debate in relation to formal politics, left v right, and things like that.
No, sure. I mean, I identify with the traditional left, and what I mean by that is the kind of things that you refer to, Jim. That, you know, for me, family unity is something that is central to my personal worldview. I mention in the book that a stable family unit is the finest form of social security known to humankind, which is why I'm not necessarily in favour of the kind of big state managerialism which, for example, characterised the New Labour project. I wasn't a fan of that at all. I think in terms of taking aim at capitalism, I'm not a fan of materialistic individualism, the sort of devil take the hindmost sort of individualism, which I do think poses a threat to those kind of organic social institutions such as family and community. So I talk a great deal about the atomization of communities across the country. One point I'm in the book, I actually state that we're a world-leading country when it comes to providing anti-discrimination protections on the grounds of race, ethnicity, and religion. But we're also an international hotspot when it comes to family breakdown. And I think that in social policy circles, that really isn't talked about enough at all. And I think when you look at youth outcomes, family structure counts for a great deal. And I do talk, and unashamedly, I do offer a defence of the sort of conventional family unit, two parents, married. And that's not taking away the fantastic work that many single parents do up and down the country. But when the evidence is telling you that certain family models are more strongly associated with positive youth outcomes, well, I'm sorry, I don't have any time for political correctness when the evidence is staring at me right in the face. I think that more generally, when I talk about faith, I know that might be a controversial area for many people. I talk about the large-scale public disorder that we saw in Leicester, primarily between Muslim and Hindu youths. But that's very much a sort of tribal religious identity politics, and I think that we've seen that really come to the fore in the last few weeks. What I argue for in the book is a more shared appreciation of faith, which really is very family-focused, community spirited, and I think that sort of interfaith understanding, I think that should play a part in this sort of, you know, left in the left in terms of helping it reconnect with more traditional minded communities. So I think that more generally, I don't hold much hope that this will happen anytime soon within the Labour Party, but I'm glad to see that there are more and more people on the left. I think Paul Embury is another example who talks about those social institutions, and I think that many people are very state-focused. What I look at more is the sort of civic institutions, those organic social institutions in local communities that can really provide young people in particular with a really strong sense of belonging and rootedness.
Thank you, Rakib. Remy, something from your book that I'd like you just to sort of flesh out just a little bit, and you have a little bit in your talk already, is that you identify in EDI, equality, diversity and inclusion, which has obviously been very much on the rise in businesses and educational institutions like the ones that you work in, as, and I quote, you refer to it at one point as a feminization of white power. And you see that there's a kind of positive side to this. You also refer to it as a strategic, potentially anyway, as a strategic positive for racial minorities, as it has delegitimized the use of overt aggression and intimidation in the exercise of power. I think that's the quote from the book there. So clearly you see that there's some potential and something positive there, potential at least, in that. Likewise, in relation to the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd, you refer to that in terms of greater sort of moral power for anti-racism. So clearly there's something very, you know, there's a positive potential there. Yet at the same time, alongside that, you argue that, you refer to the ideology of white supremacy, which is part of the whole debate that is very central to EDI. You refer to it as so clever it continues to bamboozle the world for no logical reason.
No, as anti-racist portraying it as if it's so clever it continues to bamboozle the world for no logical reason.
Okay.
That's what I mean. So what I meant by that, this particular quote you gave, is that sort of the anti-racist narrative is that the reason why, let's call it white people, white Westerners, enjoy the power and status they have today is because of the ideology of white supremacy, which they attribute some kind of magical, almost near magical-like powers, as if this, you know, that ideology exists out there and continues to bamboozle the world for no logical reason. And we simply need to get rid of it, and that will be the end of the, you know, differences in status or in power between groups. And I argue that that's not the case. The case is actually those material foundations which I talk about.
Yeah. I suppose the point I was trying to get at was your broader point that you brought out in the introduction there, that you identify white status rather than white privilege as the key issue, and you very clearly kind of rooted that in economics, effectively wealth. And yet if you look at EDI within business, within universities, they're talking white privilege. They're not talking about how to materially raise up black people in Africa. So I'm just saying that there's a kind of tension there between this positive potential in EDI that you identify and where the discussion is actually at.
Sure, definitely. And I guess that comes from, sometimes the motivations of the various actors at play. Unfortunately, any system or movement or what we want to call EDI introduced can be abused by people, by individuals in various places. I think the whole EDI push works differently from campus to campus. It doesn't work the same in every single university. Probably works a little bit different in the University of York from how it works in the University of Oxford and other places. I think there's factors that come into play here sometimes that might be underappreciated. There's, you know, the student demographics of a university. So very often, you know, at the end of the day, the bulk very often of university incomes come from tuition fees. And trust me, many of the university, you know, authorities that operate, I have to be careful about what I say, or many universities authorities operate, they look at their student bodies and make certain assumptions as to what kind of direction they think those bodies might be interested in the university moving. So to cut a long story short, if they have very diverse student bodies, let's say there's lots of foreign students coming in, which is often the case these days, especially with master students, the university authorities might work on the assumption that we need to signal that we're doing a lot on EDI and that we're very respectful of people on a racial basis, because that will make us more attractive as a university for the foreign students who come here and pay £22,000 a year. For the privilege of studying in a British university. And so they might not necessarily actually even be doing it out of a naivete or some kind of progressive, terrible progressive push, but it's more sometimes even a business calculation. They're making the assumption that, you know, that's what will make us more attractive to Chinese students, Nigerian students, Pakistani students, etc. So that can also be a factor at play.
That's great. Thanks, Remy. Over to Doug. Doug, your book really is a very hard-hitting broadside against trends in the modern university, and there those trends are reflected elsewhere as well. And the title is Against Decolonization, which is something that's actually quite difficult to say, I think, in a university. And kudos for you for being brave enough to say that. You know, it's something that you believe very strongly. You're a professor of international relations, and you take the discussion into the realm of the future of geopolitics, really, which is something that I wanted you to perhaps just elaborate on a little bit. This is just a brief quote from your book that sort of drives the point home, I think. The desire to decolonize the Anglosphere and the adoption of identity politics by political and cultural elites, who you refer to as the professional managerial class, are suicidal moves in the context of rising illiberal and authoritarian civilizational states like China. If we do deconstruct the West, who or what will replace it? So this is pretty dramatic stuff. You know, it takes campus culture war politics that many people around race and identity politics more generally, that many people interpret in terms of cancellations on campus or fear to say certain things. And you're basically arguing over the longer term this has very, very profound implications for the future of our society. Could you just elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, yeah. So I think that the peace that we've enjoyed in Europe has rested on a kind of post-war institutional settlement, but that's not normal. Human civilizations, most of human history is characterized by war, tribal aggression, territorial acquisition, etc. And there's no reason to think that the Fukuyama's thesis about the end of history is true. We're at the end of history. We've entered into a kind of more multipolar global economy, and we have the rise of other civilizational states. Obviously, Russia has invaded Ukraine. We have China's rise now, which maybe Remy can discuss as well, because obviously that's, you know, that's interesting. And we have a kind of the tumult in the Middle East. And so we're kind of almost returning to a new world or dispensation, a more multipolar international system. So I think going into that, I think that the West, if you want to call it the West, are kind of liberal democracies. What holds them together is a kind of, to some extent, some degree of unity, liberal values, an emphasis on human dignity and human agency. No matter how imperfect that may well have been applied, the arc is pretty clear. And if we accept the fact, which is true, that the international system is characterized by international conflict, and there's no real reason to think that Western hegemony will remain. It's not remaining. I mean, look at China, look at the rise of other states and civilizational powers. Then what offer, what civilizational or normative offer will they have if they manage to sort of, you know, do the Belt and Road Initiative in Africa? I mean, maybe it's a wonderful thing, maybe it's not, I don't know. But do you see what I mean? So in other words, what we have now enjoying the West and enjoying Europe is changing. We're entering a more multipolar international system, and we're going into a kind of fragile moment. So we'll see where it ends up. But I think that identity politics, the pushing of new tribalism, is cannibalistic on the liberal norms that have prevailed in the post-war international West. It's introduced new forms of identity tribalism. It's challenged some of the really fundamental values of human dignity and human universalism. That's what drove the anti-racist campaigns, for example, in America, an emphasis on a human common humanity. And it's pitted groups against each other. And if you think that's a healthy way, not you, but if one thinks that that's a healthy way to face what's coming down the track, and stuff is coming down the track, trust me, then good luck with that. Because, so in other words, I think we need to sort of rediscover a sort of common humanity. And I think identity politics has been absolutely a catastrophic mistake, driven by useful idiots, guilty white liberals, and then even the replacement, I mean, even on a kind of left-wing level, to replace a kind of class or socioeconomic analysis with racial identity politics as a way forward has been absolutely disastrous for left-wing politics. I mean, why you talk about white privilege when instead of class privilege, given the fact that if you look at the data, for example, on ethnic minorities, some of the richest ethnic minorities in this country are East Asians and Indians. Same with educational outcomes. I mean, the data does not bear out this idea. Or you take white kids from Mayfair down the road or Westminster, and you go to white kids in Hull and talk about white privilege. It's frankly morally disgusting. So I think that's a big thing. I think that's a big thing. So my point about geopolitics is that where we're at is not normal. We've enjoyed 70-odd years based on two major world wars and an international dispensation underpinned by American hegemony. That's under great strain. We are entering into a more multipolar international system, and we need all the resources we have right now to hold us together. Otherwise, we're going to go into a very, very dark place.
Yeah, do you want to come on?
Yes, I totally agreed. One, definitely on the fact that identity politics is cannibalistic and ultimately leads nowhere, definitely to zero-sum thinking. And two, definitely we are living in a more multipolar world now. We see all the conflicts around the world and emerging powers around the world. That's definitely true. I definitely say Brits, if we're talking here, not to talk too generally about the West, do need to somehow rediscover their identity and grow a backbone once again. Yeah. And grow a backbone once again, because really, there is a reason why Western countries are held to higher moral standards than other countries. There's a reason for that. And so human rights abuses that happen in many other parts of the world, very often when they happen, nobody even takes notice, nobody even really talks about it, because there's sort of this assumption that, oh, well, you know, that's how things work over there, which, of course, has its own bad side. But when such things happen here in the UK or in France or generally in any Western country, there's very often an outcry because Western nations are held to higher standards than others. Nobody actually explains why this should be the case very often, but I think it is the case simply because the standards kept in the Western world on human rights and generally speaking on decency, on fairness, and on justness. I mean, it's difficult to point to fairer societies than the ones here in the West. They're definitely not perfect. Britain is definitely not perfect. No country is perfect. That's, you know, a cliche I shouldn't have to say. But it's difficult to point to fairer and more just societies. And so also, I'd say, you know, Western societies need to rediscover themselves, rediscover a backbone, because indeed, as Doug says, winter is coming.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Rakib, and then out to the audience.
Yeah, I mean, I just following Doug's points on white privilege, I think three real advantages that a young person can have in their life is being part and belonging to a stable and attentive two-parent family unit, having good connections with their grandparents and other family elders, and being part of a tight-knit community, a tight-knit local community. And if you consider that to be genuine advantages, then there's many ethnic minority communities which are in far better shape and have more privilege than much of the white British mainstream in this country.
That, Rakib. Now, out to the audience, there's so many different things that we could come in on, and please, you know, feel free to comment, question, disagree, that's all fine. So we're going to, just to make my life easier, we're going to start over on the left here, take the gentleman over here, and then if you pass to the gentleman next, and along the line to yourself. Yep.
Hi, thanks guys for such a nuanced conversation. I was observing the Australian The Voice referendum, and I saw that its defeat was sort of marked on one side as, you know, a global pushback against identity politics, but on the other side, maybe it was blamed on racism why it was defeated. I wonder, did you have any views on that?
Okay, we'll take a couple more, and then panel, feel free to come back on the ones you want to, but we're not going to be able to cover everything, obviously. Yeah, gentlemen here, yeah.
Hi, cheers. So I was just thinking about a lot of things that were said, and as personally someone from a South Asian background, I am seeing that. I feel that for a lot of like young black kids, especially with wealth creation, I think that it should start at home instead. Because unfortunately, I'm seeing a lot of young black kids fall into quite bad circles. In particular, when the role models for young black kids, who quite often come from fathers, come from single-parent homes, a lot of their role models tend to be like Stormzy, these drill rappers who do glorify things that don't work in well with black wealth creation. And then in particular, when a lot of that starts with a home and having a stable two-parent family, I think it should start there instead. And I also think that the conversation around diversity, equality, and inclusivity in universities, in particular as someone who is a PhD student in quite Western university, I think a lot of these DEI policies aren't really for a lot of the Chinese students. It's actually for the Western students who are coming here. And a lot of university fees do come from the Chinese students and international students. And I think the Chinese students don't really care about DEI. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of them here are...
But
the
university authorities don't know that.
Yeah, exactly. This is the thing. So it's one of those weird things. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
Thanks for that. Yes. This one here, yeah.
Thank you, and really nice conversation. My comment and questions, probably to you, Remy, mostly. I really like your thesis around thinking about what's happening in the world in terms of an economic perspective. I think in terms of all this conversation, one of the things that strikes me here in Britain, for example, or in the West, where we're supposed to be so alert to racial inequalities, is an area that we don't seem to talk about. And that's, I'm thinking about, for example, in the UAE, where there's a huge influx of people, often women, mostly women from the Philippines, who come in. It's some would say a form of modern slavery, often, for these women who are exploited. And yet, within our society, where we're so supposed to be so alert to this at the moment, this is never spoken about. You could certainly see it within your thesis of the sort of economical hierarchy. But I was just wondering about that and why you think that we're not talking about that. That structure doesn't follow the sort of white down to black sort of hierarchy, and yet here it is in our face, or at least in my face. But yet we don't speak about it.
So we're going to take one more. The gentleman just here. Everybody will get a chance to speak. I'll bring the panel in to deal with any of these points. Go ahead.
Thanks very much. I'll try and be as quick as I can. Rakib, it's going to sort of link a little bit to what you were saying, but I'm sure that all the panel will want to jump in about sort of the social conservative values that are often not respected of these ethnic minority communities. I went to a grammar school in southeast London. 70% of the year group was Asian. 20% was white, 10% was black. I remember after the George Floyd instance when actually an amazing thing happened and students started talking about how their teachers had been racially discriminatory towards them. And the teacher's response to that was not to accept that they were wrong, was to push all this woke EDI stuff to try and claim that they were right about race relations. And actually a lot of the kids turned around and said, no, our problem isn't that you guys need to do more of the indoctrinating us. The problem is you don't respect our values. What ethnically diverse kids in my school had a problem with was when at gay pride weeks, they were forced to wear mufti clothes that were rainbow coloured, even though it didn't respect their values. Their issue is that their culture was not respected in this country. And that was the problem they had. And the teachers, white, liberal, middle class, would never listen to them. They felt they weren't being listened to, which was a theme I got from all three of you. Is that the experience that you guys feel? Because young, often male, but can be female as well, religious kids of my generation are absolutely fed up of being told how to think when the left claims to support immigrant communities in this country. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to take the panel. Obviously, this discussion is going to be quite broad, so do feel free to be very selective. And likewise in the audience, if you want to come back on points that are made within the audience or the panel, you should do that too. Start with you, Doug.
Okay. Thank you very much. So I don't know much about the Australian vote, unfortunately, and I would want to treat that with the dignity it deserves, and I just don't know enough to speak about that. So that's that. On the point about the kids coming, the international students, I completely agree. I mean, I have a lot of Chinese students. A lot of my PhD students are from Nigeria. I have a lot of Nigerian students. I've taught most of my students are actually ethnic minority, right? I've never found one that's come and said, you know what, I'm going to come in here because I want the EDI values. It's not like that at all. I mean, they come, you know, they want basically to have a really broad, respectful, but really good education. They want to be pushed. They want to learn, and they're doing it because they want to go back and you know get good careers and stuff like that. So I don't know any of my students ever historically over a 25-year career has ever said to me, from an ethnic minority at least, international especially, they've come in because they want the values of ED or sort of guilty white liberals to tell them, you know, blah 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 blah. Nah, that's not what they come in. Also, your point about the black kids. It's a really interesting point as well, because it's something I touch upon, but I hasten to say this sitting next to Rakib, who I think has mostly done a much better job than I could on the so-called black category. Because even there, you look at the data on the black category, and you've got Afro-Caribbean kids, but also kids from African heritage backgrounds. And they're very differential outcomes. And if you look at that, so for educational outcomes, the African kids tend to do much better, much higher rates of parents still together, much stronger cultural values placed on education and getting good jobs and good careers, etc. So there's a really, and then that's also reflecting a lot of data. They tend to do much better at GCSE, much lower expulsion rates than I think the white majority. I think I'm right. Afro-Caribbean are higher. So even when within that black category, you've got really differential outcomes in relation to where this category, which is treated as a kind of undifferentiated mass, which is frankly patronising and very odd, is itself has differential outcome. I'm sure Rakib and Remy can do a much better job than me on that, but that's a really interesting point. And this one, I mean, Jack, I think that was a really counterintuitive point, and that's done. But I'm sure Rakib again and Remy can talk much better on that.
No, of course. I think in terms of the referendum in Australia, I think what was really interesting there that among the Aboriginal population, there was a great deal of diversity of viewpoint, which I think that was quite revealing, actually, because many people would see that group as a monolithic, homogenous bloc. So I actually think that was a positive in a way that emerged. But saying that, with my own personal background being a British Bangladeshi Muslim, even though the weather's a lot better there, I'd much prefer to be in the UK than Australia, to be honest, for some of the reasons that I explained earlier, especially when it comes to the provision of anti-discrimination protections on the basis of race, ethnicity and religion. In terms of Hassan's point, it's something that I've talked about a lot. In many parts of inner city London, but other cities, there are American-inspired subcultures which, in my view, glorify hypermaterialism, violence and degeneracy. And I think that is a serious problem, especially in communities which have relatively high rates of lone parent households, in my view, a fatherlessness epidemic. And I think that's a real shame that David Lammy actually flagged this around the time of the Tottenham riots before he became an identitarian opportunist. He was actually one of my favourite, actually genuinely, truly, probably one of my favourite politicians growing up. And it shows that maybe he suffered some kind of career flatlining and he thought this was a way to really, in a sense, become more popular in certain circles on the left. Doug makes a point, though, that which is very important, that the British black population is incredibly diverse. And if you're even looking within the black African category, that would include very well-established migrants of West African origin, who may well be the children of the students who stayed in the 1960s. It could also include very newly arrived refugees from the Horn of Africa who may follow the Islamic faith, or those migrants may be Anglican. So I think the black African population now is actually large enough in the UK for those splits to take place, especially when it comes to census data, and that's something that I'm actually pushing for. But Doug is absolutely correct that when it comes to educational outcomes, pupils in England of black African origin fare better than the white British mainstream in terms of attainment 8, which is sort of the average score across 8 GCSE level qualifications, less likely to be expelled. But then that pattern is reversed when it comes to their co-racial counterparts of black Caribbean origin. And I think that when it comes to education and other spheres of British life, talking a great deal about race, but we don't talk enough about culture. And I think that would be a very important development if we were to do so.
Thanks, Rakib. Remy.
Thank you. On the UAE question, thanks for raising that, because I think that plays well into the argument I make of how it's economics that decides the hierarchies, how you say. A friend of mine of Middle Eastern descent recently went to Dubai, and he worked there at an American university there. After 6 months, he quit and came back and told me, you know what, I couldn't take it anymore because the hierarchy system there is so strict. And what was the hierarchy system there? So you had the Emiratis, of course, at the top. And then amongst foreign workers, he said, at the top you had the white Westerners, white Western academics. So from the Britons, the Frances, etc., they were treated very respectfully. Treated much worse were white Europeans from poorer European countries. So academics, he'd say, from Serbia, from Bulgaria, from Romania, who had the same qualifications as the white Western academics, were treated much less respectfully by the Emiratis there because they're from poorer countries than the UAE. And then you had the other groups sort of going down, and essentially it was based on what country you came from and how wealthy the country you come from is. That's how essentially people are treated. And unfortunately, that's how it works in most of the world. That's how it works in most of the world. And in fact, it works, I'd say, least like that in Western countries like Britain. At least it's covert. It's not in your face. It's not showing you like that. But in most of the parts of the world, it's in your face. And unfortunately, that's how it is. So yeah, that's a good example.
Thanks, Remy. So I'm going to take the middle portion here. We're going to get to everybody, don't worry. So gentleman here, and then two people towards the back. Two people there.
Thanks. Mine's more of a comment on what's been said about identity groups. I feel that in our society, well, we have what, you know, what's been said by a Nigerian American author about the danger of a single story. There is a tendency in this country to read one book about a particular ethnic minority, and then that becomes the story. You become an expert on, say, Caribbean culture because you've listened to that one album by Linton Kwesi Johnson. And I think that's what's creating some of the problems where, it's like, you know, who was it who said that the teachers couldn't understand the ethnic minority students because they've read one book and they think, yeah, well, I know these Nigerians because we need to move away from that. We need to understand that it's not enough to class people as black when there are so many. I'm a Zimbabwean. I'm from Zimbabwe. I probably have more in common culturally with people from Southern Africa. Angola, yes. See, we will probably have more in common than, say, someone from Somalia or Nigeria or whatever. So if you've got a Nigerian neighbor, don't assume that I'm going to know anything about their food or whatever. Right, I'm rambling on. But yeah, that's what we need to move away from that. There was someone else who said something about family structures and the interest in drill. I live in Middlesbrough, and I can tell you, it's very different over there. Black families are intact, and you can see the progress. You know, people come in, they live in two rooms, a family of five, and then 5 years later, they've got their own place. So it is happening. It's just not happening so much in places like London. And that is why more and more black families are moving away from those places, away from the influence of, like, the drill culture, because it's counterproductive.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, lady right there, and then at the back.
Thank you. I have a question for Rakib and also one for Doug. On the two-parent family thing, I take your point completely, and the data shows that two-parent families lead to better outcomes for the kids. But and I'm from a two-parent family, so, you know, I'm not disputing it, but I took that question to a friend of mine who lives in Ilford, who is he's actually mixed white Chinese. And he can't walk around Ilford after five because he kind of presents as white, so everyone thinks he's a crackhead. Because the only people in Ilford, the only non-South Asian people in Ilford are black and white that come in from other places to buy drugs. And everybody else who's, all of the actual drug pushers are South Asian teenage boys in cars. And so he said, you know, they're South Asians. I mean, I was making assumptions, but I know South Asian culture quite well. I'm half Indian. You know, they're going to be from two-parent families. So, you know, the idea is the fathers at home will control those boys. Well, those South Asian fathers are not controlling their boys. So this friend of mine said it's the housing crisis, which is making people think, well, there's no point going to school or doing well because you're not going to be able to afford anything, so it's better to go into drugs. And controversially, he says, because the mothers are kind of, you know, imported from the subcontinent, there's not a respect for them within the family, and so they can't control their sons. And I do think that there is a bit of a dirty secret about some South Asian culture. Like, yeah, South Asians tend to do really well now, like the PM is, you know, South Asian, but there can be quite a lot of problems at home sometimes. So the families stay together, and you might do well at school, but you might not necessarily be having the best time. So I'd like to challenge, like, it might be more about wealth, because there is a distinction between South Asians in the UK, like the East African route, which is where my dad came from, you know, tends to be like, look at the Tory front bench. And then you've got other South Asians, the Ilford people, apologies if anyone's from Ilford, I'm not like making broad generalizations, but, you know, please come in if you're from there. You know, I don't think are from that same background. So I think we're probably forgetting the wealth factor in this argument. And I would say more than marriage staying together, it's the emphasis on education is the key thing that I reckon will make people succeed. Although I don't discount that two parents help. And my question for Doug is, why do you think all of this is happening? One of my theories is that white people who have not grown up around ethnic minorities, sort of coming in from the shires, don't really see people of colour as kind of real is the wrong word, but they don't kind of just see them as normal. It's like, oh, there's a black person, there's a brown person, there's a Muslim, there's a whatever. And so they, then get to these universities that might be their first real experience of normal people of colour. And they have been told this stuff about their privilege, and they kind of really want to, they really want to learn, and so they engage with all of this stuff. Whereas someone that might have grown up, you know, in an inner city setting and just knows black people or knows Indians will just be like, well, these are just normal people. And so there's less of an interest in engaging. Like, that's why this is such a middle class phenomenon, I'd argue. And I think that, as a point I made yesterday in one of the larger rooms, I didn't explain it very well, but I feel that there's this, sort of covert hierarchy that Remy's alluded to. I think it does exist to some extent in people's minds. And by going on about racism all the time, white people going on about it, like white people have like told me how I'm a victim of this or that when I haven't thought about it that much. Not I'm denying racism, I have experienced it, but not that much in 2023 in London. I think it's because it, by going on about it, it actually reinforces in their own heads that A, there's a problem and it gives like an opportunity for white saviorism. But it also keeps them actually higher in the pecking order, because if we are victims and if we believe we're victims, then they are still on top. And I think that's a high... I don't think it's subconscious, but I think it's an unexamined aspect of the ideology from the perspective of a kind of a well-meaning person that grew up in, say, you know, Hampshire. No offence again.
These are absolutely brilliant points.
Sorry, I'll stop.
No, thank you, really. Please let you continue. The woman at the back and then the gentleman in front there.
Right wing, they have divided the society in terms of race and religion and sexuality. And we know that populism is on rise, and we see that these people are just paddling these narratives about the even ordinary people who have nothing to do with politics. But we see that the progressives, they have also divided the society in terms of race and sexuality, and then faith groups. And when, I mean, it's very tragic that in 2023 in London, when progressives, they look at me, all they can see is that there is a brown woman. And I find it really strange, because this is what we have been fighting against, but somehow people who claim to be progressive, they have adopted the language of right wing. I mean, under the banner of identity politics, they both are speaking the same languages, same semantics have been used on both sides. And the people who are dissenters, I mean, within the minority groups, I would say, those who are, you know, claim to gather the whole community under the banner of identity politics, when there are people who are dissenting and having different opposing views, they are receiving backlash from within the community. So it's a very toxic form of politics that has been going on, and that, in my view, this kind of callous attitude on the part of progressive is giving credence to the politics of right-wing, I would say, and to those who are racist and who are supremacist and who see society just who look at the people and all they can see is colours.
Thanks very much. Yeah, gentlemen.
I'm just going to start by the question I want to ask you, and then I'll very quickly give my own view on it, if that's all right. Mm-hmm. What I would ask is, isn't the debate that we have today about race and identity issues more broadly in Britain about the relationship between liberalism and capitalism? And how I would respond to that myself would be that post-World War II, liberalism, social liberalism, and social liberals, those who were not interested in economic issues, material concerns, put a focus upon reforms as a way to divert attention from material issues. However, yes, there was terrible discrimination along lines of race, sexuality, and sex. And so the social reforms that were required were put in place. And Raqib said earlier, I would argue they reached their zenith and end point with the 2010 Equality Act. Now, why do we, as we've reached that end point, have an obsession, a concern with inequality and with victimhood, when actually we all know, we've all seen every survey going, the levels of this discrimination that's out there is disappearing. It's far lower than it was before. Isn't it strange that that occurs, that embrace of cultural liberalism occurs exactly the same point as the 2008 crash, occurs at the same point as left populism starts to take off in response to that? Isn't it the case that, in fact, the reason why we're in this room having this debate is because corporations and the military-industrial complex have decided that it is in their interests to actually use divide-and-rule tactics to put people against each other, to stop them coming together, to actually focus on material concerns?
Okay, I'm going to bring the panel back in to come back on any of these points, starting with Remy and across.
If I could, excellent point I liked with regards to what was mentioned on status and why white middle-class people might act in the way they act, which the lady mentioned. And I completely agree with that. So generally speaking, human beings are hierarchical creatures, and all social psychology and literature, even those which try to sort of develop strategies against hierarchies, acknowledge this. All human societies are organized into hierarchies which are more or less aggressively imposed. In our status hierarchies, envy is directed upwards, pity is directed downwards. And so this white middle class people you talk about assume the position of the pitier, and the pitier is positioned above. And when that position is assumed, the way they will approach it is like, oh, alas, and I wrote about this in the book, I am here above you, which I wouldn't want to be. So there's a signal of the moral disapproval of the order that positioned me here. But alas, I am here above you. But I'm one of the good ones. Don't worry. I will help. And so at the end of the day, this person gets to gain some kind of moral authority and at the same time keep their material position. So that's a win-win. It's a win-win for that white middle-class person, yeah? Not necessarily for the person who is being pitied there. And there is only a need for helpers where there is a dependency kind of relationship. That's only when helpers are needed and when there are this serious asymmetrical power dynamics and power relations, yeah? So as you say, like I'd say, it's a win-win for them and it's adopting that position of the pitier. And that's one. I think there was a... Okay, maybe I'll let someone else speak on the other issues.
And I think in terms of the lady's point about two-parent households and talking about the troubles of Ilford, unfortunately, I don't find myself in Ilford that often. Luton's gives me enough of a testing time. I think that in terms of family structure and the relationship between those youth outcomes, there's no doubt that someone can be brought up in a single-parent home and go on to achieve astonishing things. And then someone who's raised in a two-parent household can end up in the criminal justice system. But ultimately, the point I was making is about the strength of the association. And there are certain family structures which are more strongly associated with positive youth outcomes, whether that's mental health, physical well-being, life satisfaction, and that naturally taps into level of school attainment, and then further down the line, labour market integration. So I completely take the point that you all have cases which work against the general pattern of association. But ultimately, if you're designing social policy, you have to go with where the associations are the strongest. And I think that more generally, I just think family structure should be talked about a lot more when it comes to social policy. And you also made a point about wealth. I think that is an important point. But when you look at levels of school attainment, I'll give you one example. Bangladeshi origin pupils on free school meals generally perform better than Black Caribbean pupils who are not on free school meals. So that would tell me that even though I do think there can be a class effect when it comes to education attainment, I do think the strength of cultural values, and it's something you talked about, the emphasis on education within the household certainly counts for a lot. Moving on to Khadija's point,
Well, I talk about tribal identitarians a great deal in my book, and I think that unfortunately the mainstream liberal media has to take a lot of responsibility for much of the divisiveness that we see in British society. When I was growing up, the amount of times I saw Anjum Chowdhury on BBC Newsnight as the official, some kind of de facto British Muslim spokesperson, I think was actually incredibly insulting towards many British Muslims when I was growing up. And I think that when it comes to the wider Black British population, my good friend here obviously talks about the incredible diversity which characterises that population. I think that there's the voices which have been platformed, the amount of times that Kehinde Andrews, the professor of so-called Black Studies...
Your friend.
Indeed, very good friend of mine. How often his platform compared to... I'm not necessarily talking about sort of right-wing racism denialists, but someone who just have a more moderate, evidence-based approach to understanding race relations in the country is quite remarkable. I think that now the gentleman's point about why is there such a strong emphasis on race, I'll be honest with you, I think many middle-class, white, liberal progressives, they use racial identity politics as an instrument to deflect attention away from their own position of socioeconomic privilege. That's what it boils down to. I remember a poll by the Social Mobility Commission back in 2019. It found that over 3 in 4 Brits felt that the gap between different social classes was too large. 3 in 4 people in this country are not Marxists. That probably include a lot of traditional old-fashioned Tories within that 77%, which tells me that really class-based barriers are still a problem in the country. There's an incredible emphasis on race, and I think that's largely because many of the people, especially in sort of left-leaning public institutions, they're almost ashamed of their own privilege. So in a sense, racial identity politics offers them an avenue to appear rebellious. I'm working against the system. I want to improve the system. When in reality, they benefit a great deal from the status quo.
And corporates do the same, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They won't want to talk much about workers' rights or sort of parental rights, especially when there's a new child that's been born into a family. But if they think that they can talk a great deal about unconscious bias, they can give themselves a little pat on the back. But that doesn't really solve the issue of economic precariousness in the country at large.
Of course, definitely. Or donate, if you're a big, you know, tech billionaire, donate $1 million to some movement or foundation that's, you know, fighting inequality, etc. And, you know, you've done your part and, you know, you have your PR. You can say, I donated $1 million to XYZ movement that's, you know, fighting for such and such group. And that's it. I'm a good guy, but I get to keep my billions.
Yeah, so I kind of pretty much agree with most of what's just been said. I try to unpack in the book, because for me, I try to relate some of these big issues in social theory, in Western politics, to a deeper underlying structure or political economy. So what I try to do in the book, towards the end of the book at least, is relate some of this, the symbolic or this new moral economies that are emerging under neoliberalism and globalization in the West, especially in the Anglophone world as well. And so I like the idea of the, I mean, I use the idea of the progressive managerial elite. So under globalization and neoliberalism in particular, these kind of traditional institutions kind of have a kind of almost a collapse of their social purpose. So the way in which they rediscover a telos, if you will, is a kind of new moral economy. And a lot of that moral economy, it's basically a corporate moral economy, where the leaders will breathe new life into their corporations and their universities, etc., through a process of progressive upliftment of endlessly vulnerable populations. And you see that all the time. You saw it on COVID. You see it on all this kind of so-called woke stuff. It's always these endlessly vulnerable populations that are out there that need to be saved and managed in some ways. A very kind of Blairite, technocratic kind of discourse, if you will. And lo and behold, who's going to do the saving? The people that run the corporations, the people that run the universities. Do you see what I mean? So it's this constant breathing moral directionality and moral life into these kind of universities now. They're big businesses. Exeter, they're big, they make hundreds of millions of pounds a year, right? So a lot of this is exactly about this kind of like breathing this life into it. Going back to the point at the back there as well, it's a really interesting point that I'm sure you've seen some of those insofar as, was this a response to the kind of anti-globalization movement, right? I mean, so I think that's a very, and I think I agree with that as well. You see these memes now of people protesting against the you used the example of the military-industrial complex, and now you've got Rayathon and BAE sponsoring gay pride marches and stuff like this. So it's a way of basically, again, signalling that virtue while leaving a lot of the political economy pretty much untouched. But this is the big point as well, and that is highly cannibalistic on necessary social norms and the kind of the necessary forms of togetherness in intra-class and also interracial solidarity that we need to protect, because it's using this tribalism to play people off against each other. And lo and behold, you have these enlightened elites. I was very struck by, and I'd urge you all to get this, it's a great book by a French philosopher called Pascal Bruckner, who wrote a book called The Tyranny of Guilt, or something like The Tyranny of Guilt. And essentially in that, he talks about this kind of it's a very Western sort of thing where we are the guilty party. We've committed great sin across the world, and you know we must atone for that. And in that, there's an innate narcissism where once again Europe, very Eurocentric, is placed once again right at the centre of world history, and it denudes the agency and dignity of non-Western civilizations and histories. Do you see what I mean? It's this kind of really weird form of Eurocentric narcissism, very also strong in the post-Protestant, increasingly secular Anglophone world, America and the UK, where a lot of the woke, so-called woke stuff or identity politics does follow a kind of secular, almost rigid script of denigration, guilt, testimony and upliftment through allyship, etc.
Yeah, no, if I just make this point very quickly, following on Doug's point, it reminds me the point you just made about a recent study by Crest Advisory, a crime and justice consultancy, and it found that 3 in 4 British Muslims believe that Britain is a good place to live for their co-religionists. I think that dropped down to 55% among the wider general public. So the perception of Britain being an Islamophobic society is more prevalent among non-Muslims than British Muslims themselves. Why?
Okay, there's lots of people who want to speak. I'm going to try and get everybody in, but I would ask you to stick to one point and be concise. So we're going to start over here, gentlemen here, and then the two gentlemen on the front row. Chap at the end here.
Hello there. We hear a lot of emphasis on white on black racism, but in the last 3 weeks, we've seen a huge amount of anti-Semitism in London and throughout the country. But that seems to get ignored because, of course, the majority of Jews here are white. I just wondered what advice you would give to the 400,000 Jews here who are thinking, do we actually have a home here? Because I'm actually probably advise my children to leave as soon as they can.
Here.
Yeah, so I have a question. I'm from Trinidad and Tobago. I was a child of a Windrush. Actually, yesterday I saw a bus, which I kind of found it, that with Windrush written all over it and faces and all that. This has this is separating me from being British. It's divisive, you know. I really found that offensive. But what I want to ask you is the Guardian's Cotton Capital series, reparations. When that came out, I was actually in Trinidad at the time, and I read it, and many people actually could read The Guardian because it's free. And so I discussed it with many people, but in the public sphere, there was not one article in any newspaper on reparations. It's a non-issue in the Caribbean, or at least in Trinidad. Every island is different. Grenada is slightly different because of what's happened recently there, and Jamaica has, you know, it's some free money. And but it has no traction at all. And I came here to London in Black History Week or month, and I went to many university debates, and every debate almost universally brought up reparations and how wonderful we are and how we're going to pay back somehow this money to, you know, 4 generations ago. And it seemed to me really disingenuous. What was most surprising was how universal, it was like groupthink, that this is the thing to do. And like I would query it, and it was like, no, you can't query it because this is, we have decided this is what we are going to give you all. And in the Caribbean, many NGOs tell us what we're going to get. So we will get like a bus to from an NGO to stop land erosion, for example. It will come, it will drive around the country with somebody who has no, you know, half trained, has no knowledge of it, and then it will park in the ministry's car park and rot. You know, it's a one way, being told what we're going to get, and NGOs do that in Africa big time. So I feel very much this is like they want to make me a victim, right? So they can have power over me, because that's a really powerful way of getting control of my story. And The Guardian did that in a big way. They wanted to take black people's story and make it their own and monetize it for their own ends.
Yeah, that's a really, really strong point. There was actually a discussion on reparations yesterday. I'm sure if people missed that, it will no doubt be recorded at some point. I'm going to try and get everybody in. You're going to have to be really short or some people will miss out. So we're going to go gentleman here, gentleman in the middle there, and gentleman with the white top at the front here.
Yeah, shame that I have
really,
to keep
really
it short.
Yeah,
you said it. So I want to go to Dr. Remy Adekoya's comments. It felt to me that what your diagnosis was pretty much just descriptive as opposed to prescriptive. And I want to basically get your take on the African lions and the Asian tiger economies, what they have managed to do as they've risen up or as they are rising up is bring in more capitalism. Capitalism has been the answer, as opposed to what I felt you were hinting at is the sort of the cause to their poverty. So keen to hear your thoughts. Thank you.
Thanks. Gentleman in the middle.
Thank you. Yeah, great discussion. I suppose
for me,
one of the key things coming through this discussion is about the two-parent family and the stable family environment for the best outcomes, and also the wealth capital argument that Remy's talked about. I think the two sort of can dovetail. I suppose it might be the million-dollar question, but does the panel have any views about how we get more stable families, particularly, say, in the black community? And I appreciate your point. Maybe it's a London thing or big city issue going on. And I don't know, maybe the cat's out of the bag in terms of, you know, there was a stigma about having children out of wedlock before. And, you know, in the old day, you know, you lie in your bed, you make your bed and you accept it. But, you know, unfortunately, fathers seem to be walking away from their fatherly parental responsibilities and creating a problem. And I also think there's I'm going to sound controversial here, but there's a myth about, oh, women are doing a great job. I would posit that actually single mothers aren't doing a great job in certain communities because, you know, the children are running feral and ending up in the criminal justice system. So actually, I think we need to stop saying mothers are fantastic because they're not doing a great job with black boys in particular. They might be doing great with the girls because a mother can be a role model to her daughter, but I don't think she can be to her son in the same way. So I think we need to move away from that deifying mothers, all of them mothers, because they're not doing a great job when it comes to black boys. And at the end of the day, they are their children. You know, they say, that's my child, that's my son, that's my daughter. So you have to take the glory with the negative, I'm afraid. So,
with a majority of white British...
Sorry, I'm just wondering, anybody else who wants to speak, put your hand up while he's speaking.
Okay. With a majority of white British people even just not talking about race due to fear of being offensive or just indifference, and the fact that there seems to be emerging conflict between black and Asian communities, as exemplified by the Peckham-Hare incident from a few weeks ago, where does that leave the future of race if white people are even in part of the conversation?
Thanks. There's three people had hands up behind. The lady there, and then the two gentlemen at the back.
I want to talk a little bit about employers, if I may. I'm not sure we've really talked about employers and what the hell's going on with their DEI departments. I do a lot of work in this area, and I see some crazy stuff going on, particularly from white women in their 40s, which is my demographic, but it's nutty what's going on. And I think something... this is a panel of men, and you've all been very polite. but I think there's something very weird going on with women. There's something about overvaluing the sort of safety culture, and there's something about cancel culture, I think, is quite female as well, as a way of sort of turning your back on someone that's got the wrong ideas. And also the sort of praising of emotional reasoning and lived experience, I think, is a very... the minute someone's crying, they're right in these rooms. So I'm basically up against this kind of culture where they live in this bubble. I don't think they're at this event. To be harsh, you might say they're not very bright, but even being kind, I would say they're not intellectually curious. So there's something going on within DEI, and there's not enough black women, and there's too many white women. Just thought I'd feed that back.
Hi. So I have a saying that I'm fond of, which is the only thing black people have in common is white people. And what I mean by that is, let's say the transatlantic slave trade had never happened and you went to Africa and you were like, hey, any black people here? They'd be like, we don't know what you're talking about. We're Nigerian, we're Kenyan, we're Ethiopian, we're Eritrean, we're Congolese. Similarly, in this room, are there any white people here? Or are there English people, Irish people, Scottish people, Welsh people, French people, German people? Surely culture and ethnicity is what's actually important here. Race is just something we made up about 400 years ago. I'm apparently mixed race. It has no biological basis. What does that even mean? As far as I know, I'm not composed out of paint, so what is it that's being mixed here? So I guess my question for the panel, something I want everyone here to think about is, can we ever truly transcend racism while retaining race theory and broad categories such as white and black?
Thanks. Very much. So we're going to take the gentleman here and the woman at the back, and I'm afraid that'll have to be it.
A lot of elites in the culture have a thing, like there's a woman called Ellen DeGeneres whose moral authority rests on being nice. And she does a thing where she's nice. She's really nice. But then she went off on her staff a couple of times, and she wasn't very nice. But then she can't just turn around and say, oh, well, I had an off day, you know. Like, her actual authority rests on being nice. So then she does an apology video for 10 minutes, in which she doesn't really apologize, but then she justifies what she's doing, and it's not really an apology. And so, again, back to the moral authority of these this elite thing, she can't just turn around and say, oh, well, I had an off day, then she'd lose her job. So her moral authority rests on being nice. And that's a part of the elite thing that you were talking about.
Yes, there is this concept of a savior complex where people, progressive, they want to put people from minority backgrounds in a box. And it is labeled with identity politics. And then, of course, they have this they have to satisfy themselves that they are protecting, you know, people from minority background. And this is what I call superior complexity, I would say. But there is another thing I would extend Raqib's point, that we have a different kind of presentation on the media when it comes to minority background. Like there is always Shamima Begum and Latifa Abu Chakra who are telling the minority women that how they have been a victim of racism and discrimination and prejudice in British society. I would also call it bigotry of low expectation, because this shows that as if the minorities are devoid of bright and motivating women, and they have to chose women like Shamima Begum and Latifa Abu Chakra, who just celebrated the massacre took place on 7th October, massacre of Israeli civilian. So this is also soft bigotry of low expectation.
Thanks. Now, there was somebody else at the back. Can you fit in your contribution just in 20 seconds? Sorry, I think I might have missed you out.
I think the lady over there who was talking about women really changing... An overemphasis on safety is a real concern, because in education, I'm noticing, oh, you're unsafe, being dished out, and those words are dangerous to teachers. And they are, if you say something slightly off, like, are you really sure that you wanted to run an assembly, instead of something which would have been genuinely traditional, like Harvest Festival, that I think we want to run Black History Month and embarrass our black students talking about their black culture, which you know doesn't really fit, and you know it's not right, and you that there is a problem with white women.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, I'm going to bring the panel in for a very, very brief summing up, but I just wanted to make a very, very brief comment myself, really. One of the things that really stuck out for me in recent years was the response to the Sewell report. The Sewell report referred to, alluded to a lot of the kind of points that have been made here about culture, about family, about educational values within and between different ethnic and racial groups and so on. And that report was met with absolute rejection by the EDI community, and universities took a political stance on that. And I think what's really refreshing is we in this room have had that discussion that hasn't been taking place and should have taken place after the Sewell report. And I think that we haven't got an adequate time now to sum up, but we need to take these discussions, unresolved as they are, well beyond this room. So I'm going to bring the guys in. I can't even remember what order. It's the reverse order now, so it's Doug, first of all. Yeah.
Well, I don't have much time, but what I'll say, I can't possibly address everything, is that on reparations, I read a guy called Shelby Steele on his book called White Guilt, fantastic book, African-American thinker, brilliant book. He's really nails a lot of what we've been speaking about here. On the point about the kind of the safetyism that we see, I call that the sort of the trauma bubble. And it's like, you know, you sort of, if you say you're traumatized or you're vulnerable or you need, you know, then especially if I've seen this as well, I've seen people reduced swing like that when somebody cries. And I just think that we need to be really cognizant of that, because we're all human beings, we all have empathy, necessarily so. But it's more about being aware of how that can be weaponized and instrumentalized to sort of push through an agenda. Jim's moving, so I better shut up.
That's great, thanks. Remy.
So on the issue of wealth creation, so again, considering the fact 90% of the black people in this world live in Africa, if we're ever to speak of any kind of meaningful racial equality at the global level, Africa must succeed economically. And so the priority for me must be wealth creation. I do not know of any nation that has become rich through socialism or through communism. So definitely the only pathway forward that we've identified so far in human history is through capitalism. And so definitely we need to attract foreign capital. We need better infrastructure, and some of this is happening with cooperation with a lot of Chinese involvement on the continent. And the third key factor there would be improving education levels on the continent, which are still not up to par, considering we live in a 21st century with lots of tech innovation, and we need to get people prepared to be able to operate in this 21st century economy. Definitely. Right.
Thanks,
Rami. Rocky? I'll keep my points very, very quickly. I really worry, to be honest, and it's something I've written about, the fact that, of course, that there's uncomfortable levels of anti-Semitism in the white British mainstream, but really it's relatively high in minority communities, and that's something that's simply not talked about enough. And I think in some ways discriminatory attitudes within particular groups seems to be more acceptable. And I think quite often that comes at the expense of British Jewish security and safety, if truth be told. In terms of reparations, I know that Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean context is actually performing very well economically, has very robust internal systems of governance. So I think that the debate in terms of post-colonial development, I think people should look more at Trinidad and Tobago. And we should look at internal factors in terms of looking at why certain post-colonial states have fared better and performed better economically than others. And I think the gentleman's point about race, I think even terms such as black and Asian now are incredibly homogenizing. I think what we need to look at differences within those racial groups. And I think what that will really tell you is that culture counts for a great deal. And I think that can help us move forwards in terms of, if you want to talk about a sort of robust civic patriotism, which can help to tie together our diversity, look at those various cultures, what are their strengths, and how you can synthesize that into an inclusive patriotism for modern day Britain.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.